everybody, and welcome to The Skip Button, a podcast all about the music you love to hate. I'm your host, Ben Barzilai. Not too long ago, the band Genesis announced that they're planning a reunion tour called The Last Domino? Genesis started off as a prog rock band led by Peter Gabriel until the mid-70s, when the one and only Phil Collins went from the band's drummer to its lead singer. Phil Collins went on to have a gigantic solo career, selling an estimated 150 million records worldwide, making him one of the world's best-selling artists. If you combine his work with Genesis, his work with other artists, and his solo career, Phil Collins has had more US top 40 singles than any other artist of the 80s. And yet, ever since he stepped in as the leader of Genesis, he has been met with constant hate. Critics from the 80s have called his music soulless and shallow, and music writers today claim that his music is nothing more than a relic of the 1980s. So, where do these criticisms come from, and how do they actually hold up to a deep dive into his music? Me, personally, I've always loved Phil Collins. In fact, his song Can't Stop Loving You was one of the first songs I ever learned to play on the piano. It wasn't until later in life that I learned that hating Phil Collins is even a thing. And actually, I'm not alone in that, because when I took to Instagram with a poll asking people how they felt about a Phil Collins episode, 93% of them responded with, "Wait, people hate Phil Collins?" But if you Google the question, "Do people hate Phil Collins?" you get an endless river of think pieces on the subject. And the reason I know that is because, little behind the curtains insight into the Skip Button, that is literally how I research all of these episodes. Okay, so what does this all mean? Well, it means that there's a generational divide when it comes to Phil Collins. If you're a millennial like me, you probably associate Phil Collins with one of two things. One of them is his song In the Air Tonight, and obviously we're going to talk about that later. But the other is his objectively amazing soundtrack to the movie Tarzan. If these are the only two things you know about Phil Collins, then why on earth would you ever hate him? I'm going to talk about several theories I have about where all this animosity comes from. The first is the fact that the negativity that Phil Collins gets stems from something that came long before Tarzan, something that even came long before In the Air Tonight, which was his first single. It starts with Genesis.
Yeah, when I saw your topic, when I saw it float up on the thing, I was like, oh my god, I actually do have such a deep, like, birth-seated connection with this, because I was...
That's my friend Colin Purcell. Out of all the 25-year-olds I know, he's easily the oldest. So I figured he was a good person to talk to about this generational divide.
Yeah, so like growing up, my parents were deadheads and shit, so a lot of that, a lot of Grateful Dead. For progressive rock, like Genesis was something that my dad was a huge fan of and played a lot of.
So Colin's parents were huge Genesis fans, and to hear him tell it, one of the many things that this taught him was a deep-seated hatred for Phil Collins.
Every time I ever heard Phil Collins' name, it was, quote-unquote, the evil Phil Collins. Always the evil Phil Collins, whenever he was mentioned, no matter what. Like Tarzan came out, and it was like, oh boy, the evil Phil Collins.
Blasphemous.
Blasphemous, I know.
Damn.
And so, I mean, because he was such a Peter Gabriel fan. Peter Gabriel is there, you could barely touch him. I mean, he's a theatrical performer of the next level.
So, a little background. Genesis was formed in 1967 and was originally led by Peter Gabriel, with Collins joining as a drummer in 1970. The music that they made in this era is very, very different from the music that they made when Phil Collins eventually took over. Originally, they were a prog rock band, and they would flesh out elaborate concepts inspired by esoteric literature over the course of sometimes 20-minute-long tracks. And now's a good time to say that for all the hate that Phil Collins gets, none of it ever has anything to do with his drumming, which most people are okay admitting is some of the best of all time. But when Gabriel left the band to pursue a solo career, Collins eventually took over and gradually transitioned into a poppier sound that most casual listeners would know Genesis by.
Yeah,
lot of the original Genesis fans deeply resented this transition and blamed Phil Collins for, in their eyes, ruining the band.
There's like a stark line. I'm no expert, but there's a line in the sand for Genesis fans. And there's people who really love Gabriel era Genesis, and there's people who really love Collins era Genesis. And they kind of fight with each other about what is better.
Of course, that all makes it sound like Phil Collins booted Gabriel so that he could be the lead singer. Truth number one is Gabriel left on his own volition so that he could have a solo career. Truth number two is Phil didn't even want to be the lead singer when Gabriel left. Apparently, Genesis auditioned somewhere around 400 singers before Collins begrudgingly agreed to take the role. And yet, the idea that he was somehow responsible for changing this band stuck.
And so all that early 70s stuff is really what I think makes Genesis Genesis. And I think my dad hated Phil Collins because in his mind, Phil Collins broke up the band and took it to, and like just was a really bad choice to hem it after such an amazing musician as Peter Gabriel. And I think he gets a lot of flack for the way that Genesis evolved. If you're going to look at like the master list of the greatest Genesis albums of all time, they are Peter Gabriel albums.
That's objective, and I was going to interrupt him, but then he made a really simple, but I think very good point about people who argue about old Genesis versus new Genesis.
However, and this is important to note, like the Peter Gabriel era, when the best albums were being created, the drummer was Phil Collins. Like Phil Collins was on all of those albums that were so good.
So one reason that the schism in Genesis fans doesn't make all that much sense is because both sides are arguing for a band that still very much had Phil Collins in it. However, while some people argue about which version of Genesis is better, plenty of critics agree that neither version was ever all that good.
One of the things that's attributed to Collins, one of his sins, is turning Genesis from a progressive rock band into a pop band. But the ridiculous thing about that is Genesis were loathed by particularly the UK music press.
That's Bernard Zewell.
I'm Bernard Zewell. I'm a music critic and music writer, and was for 25 years the senior writer and critic for the Sydney Morning Herald, the main broadsheet newspaper in the country.
In 2019, Bernard wrote an article for The Guardian called In Defense of Phil Collins, What is the Genesis of All the Hatred? When I reached out to him, he was skeptical that he'd have a half an hour worth of stuff to say about Phil Collins, and we ended up talking for an hour and a half. Obviously, I'm not going to play the whole conversation, but it was a really enlightening discussion on what made Phil Collins such a pariah. I normally don't do this, but we started the convo with what I'm going to call a skip button mini.
First of all, you sort of bookend your sort of defense of Phil Collins with taking on the Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson duets. I have my own take on those duets, but I mean, the way that you frame it is like that is like the absolute like pinnacle of bad decision making in music. Why did you use that as an example of how bad Phil Collins could have been?
Because they really are some of the worst pieces of music ever put to tape, particularly given that they come from two of the biggest names ever in popular music. Mind you, they're also two of the people most likely to do that kind of mawkish or sentimental tripe. But the point with both of those is that they... Well, it's a little more complex with Michael Jackson, of course, but they both survived those terrible songs. Their reputations, they may have been disliked for various reasons before, and Michael Jackson had more than enough issues afterwards, but which, again, I do mention in that article, but they weren't hated for as long as Phil Collins, and in some ways weren't hated as much as Phil Collins. And I think there's more reason to hate Paul McCartney and Michael Jackson for those songs than anything Phil Collins did. And I don't even like a lot of what Phil Collins did.
Anyway, I digress. As Bernard said earlier, Genesis, with or without Peter Gabriel, was kind of a polarizing subject. Music critics didn't exactly love early Genesis as much as, say, Colin Purcell's dad did. According to Bernard, this in part had to do with all of the socioeconomic politics that came with being both a musician and a music critic.
When Peter Gabriel left Genesis, we were already on the way to punk. Mm-hmm. And in the UK, the music media had already seen the most class conscious group of people in the world, the UK music press, even though a good number of them are solid middle class white people. The music press in the UK in the 70s saw itself as bastions of the working class, representatives of, as I used earlier, real people, while Genesis were the perfect example of the pretentious, overeducated kids who were indulged and could write these pompous pieces of music that no one could possibly like unless you were someone who spent your time reading Old English, reading Chaucer in Middle English. So Genesis were hated. Genesis were loathed in so many ways, and Phil Collins turns him into a pop band, and he's loathed for turning a band that the press didn't like as a prog rock band into a pop band, and that's a bad thing. It's ridiculous.
Ridiculous as it might be, the perception of Phil Collins as one of a privileged sellout benefiting from a classist system is one that haunts him to this day. It's a lens through which so many people viewed his music, and it didn't help that Phil Collins kind of had an ego and was prone to speaking out of turn, but we'll get to that later. So in the early 80s, around the same time that Genesis was still finding their sound now that Gabriel had left, Phil Collins was beginning to venture into his own solo career, which of course is how most people now know and hate him. As per usual, the reasons people hate his solo music have as much to do with the music itself as everything that was happening around the music. But before I tell you about my deep dive into his solo career, I thought it was worth establishing what was happening in music during this period, because it's going to come more and more into play as we sort of dissect Phil Collins' legacy. The 1980s was a time of rapid change in the music industry. Experimentation with electronic instruments was gaining mainstream attention, music videos were becoming one of the industry's most powerful marketing tools, and genres like punk and hip-hop were starting to rear their heads into public consciousness. And this all left Phil Collins, a balding man already in his 30s, with plenty of detractors from the get-go, kind of left to decide what he wanted his role in this ecosystem to be. And it could have been a lose-lose situation, right? Because to make the kind of music he had been making with Genesis might have felt tired, but to keep up with the trends of new music would have felt cringy. Instead, with his debut album, Face Value, Collins has set out to make something entirely his own, a sound that was agnostic to what his old haters or young skeptics had to say about him.
He wasn't part of any particular movement. And so he became a standard bearer of the mainstream, the thing that people were resisting.
Ironically, in making this sound, his solo work has sonic characteristics that became so iconically 80s that they now feel old and dated, which is probably why Collins' music is considered, amongst other things, so corny. In order to get to the bottom of why Phil Collins' sound can feel so offensively 80s, I decided to reach out to Charlie Harding.
I'm Charlie Harding, the co-host of the Vulture podcast Switched on Pop, about the making and meaning of popular music.
If you guys enjoy the skip button and haven't listened to Switched on Pop, I highly recommend it.
First of all, I was wondering, do you like have a personal relationship with Phil Collins' music at all?
Phil Collins was played in my house a lot growing up, and there actually was not a lot of music in my house growing up, but my dad just really loves Phil Collins. So there's definitely a couple of the classic albums and definitely like some best of records that would play not infrequently.
Charlie and his co-host Nate Sloan were nice enough to include my thoughts on their episode about The Weeknd's Blinding Lights. And then Charlie was doubly nice to agree to come on my show and talk about a whole slew of topics, including why is it that the sonic qualities of Phil Collins' music can feel kind of stuck in amber?
He's early to using the Prophet 5 synthesizer, which is, a ubiquitous 80s sound. He's famous for the gated snare, big over-the-top snare drum sound. All of these things are sounds that, he was a contemporary and that I think became, that he helped popularize and just became the sound of the 1980s. And like,
by the way, Charlie recommended an amazing video called How a Recording Studio Mishap Shaped 80s Music that basically outlines how Phil Collins helped create this drum sound that ended up defining that era of music. The best example of the sound is the first song Collins ever released as a solo artist, the song that, to this day, he's probably best known for. I'm here to come. The iconic drum solo from In the Air Tonight has been memed so many times that it's easy to forget how weird and wild the whole song is. It's a searing, haunting rant over a woozy bed of synths with a dramatic, in-your-face beat drop 3/4 of the way through it. This song wasn't just a part of the 80s sound, it invented the 80s sound. And while to some this sound is kind of trite or dated, people like Charlie know that there's something actually quite timeless about it.
And these sounds have been coming back for a long time, whether through Fun or Carly Rae Jepsen or so many other artists. And I think, you know, The Weeknd has been writing on 80s material since Can't Feel My Face and probably even earlier, even mixing with his, you know, idea of sort of contemporary or nightmarish R&B. But yeah, he's definitely part of that world that's been trying to revive the 1980s and resuscitate it from its corporate death decades ago. And you know, it's working for him. Yeah.
This is something I've been thinking a lot about. If you follow me on Twitter, @barsnearme, you'll know I recently asked the question, is there a post-Phil Collins artist? An artist you can trace back to Phil Collins the same way you can trace back, say, Lady Gaga back to Madonna? I got a couple answers, like the one from someone on Phil Collins' Reddit page who suggested Francis and the Lights. May I have this dance to you? Can I say something crazy? Also, shout out to Matt Cantor, a contributor to The Guardian, who was on my Coldplay episode, who responded saying Peter Gabriel, a savage, if not kind of accurate take. I still don't know if I have a definitive answer to this question, but the closest I get to is The Weeknd. A pop star making synth-heavy, high-concept music that's danceable and yet often very, very dark. I think this first occurred to me when I heard Phil Collins' song Don't Lose My Number. Songs like The Weeknd's Blinding Lights might prove that Phil Collins' sound is much more than just a signifier of a bygone era. Another piece of evidence for this is the weirdly unknown hip-hop and R&B Phil Collins tribute album called Urban Renewal, which features artists like Lil' Kim, Brandy, and Montel Jordan. To me is against the odds. That's a chance I've gotta take. But before I get too deep into the topic of Phil Collins' legacy, we need to talk about Face Value, the album that In the Air Tonight was on, because it's an example of why I love doing this show. Because I went into this album assuming I was going to hear a soppy collection of synth-heavy love and breakup songs. Instead, what I heard was a brilliant album, won by a man born to progressive rock but raised in pop, making honest music that thoughtfully borrowed from both. There's everything here from soft rock, to full-out instrumental jams, to poetic references to rural music. It also establishes Collins as, in my opinion, one of the greatest balladeers of all time. He has a couple of really big hit ballads under his belt, but his ability to pour his heart out in a way that is both artful and gut-wrenching is clear on songs like my personal favorite, You Know What I Mean. In short, I really love this album. This music is not the synth-heavy, corny relic of the 80s that I always thought of Phil Collins as being. It's also not the sellout pop music that his detractors insist he makes. Very few songs on this album are as simple as verse, chorus, verse, chorus.
No, and that's exactly the point. His music has more variety in terms of style and structure and its approach than he's given credit for. But that's what happens when you become a hate figure. the complexities disappear. You're liked or you're loathed. You're good or you're terrible.
Despite how much Collins' albums had to offer, critics were never all that kind to him.
I don't think Phil Collins hate came from, let's say, real people. I think it started with the the critical community, if we want to call it that, and specifically the English, because I think it's a very English thing to do. Mm. I mean, hey, hating artists, I think is it's not unique to the British music press, but it's certainly a key defining characteristic of the English music press. And I think that the Phil Collins hate was driven from that. It did exist in other places, but I think often it was driven in places other than the UK by the music press. And certainly in Australia, I could see that happening. I'm not going to pretend I wasn't part of it because in the late 80s, I'm sure, and early 90s, I'm sure I derisively referred to him, if not actually sort of abusively referred to him in pieces, usually about other people. And Phil Collins was always a great reference point. Well, this is bad, but it's not Phil Collins. Or you think this is a terrible thing to do to a Motown song. Well, at least it wasn't as bland as Phil Collins, you know, so a standard reference point. So I think that's where it started and is driven.
I also want to talk about some of the songs that he's best known for, because only a handful of them are songs that he created himself from top to bottom. Take, for example, his second most streamed song on Spotify. That was, of course, You Can't Hurry Love, a cover of The Supremes, and one of, if not the most infamous song in Collins' catalog. The criticism against this song is that it's a needless cover of black music by a white man who's injecting absolutely nothing authentic into it.
You see, that's one that feels totally legitimate to be like, I if you want to trash on that, that's fine with me, because you can't cover Diana Ross. Like, white Englishmen, no. Like, you can't top it, right? And I think with the covers like 16 years after the original, you just can't beat The Supremes.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. He sings it perfectly well. It actually is fairly close to the Motown style, the Motown sound. He doesn't structurally adjust it in any way. There's nothing obviously wrong with it. The problem is that there's nothing, as you said, there's no reason for it. What does he bring to it? It has no reason to exist. Beyond the fact that they're just examples of him being a music fan. He liked those songs. He grew up with those songs.
To be honest, this is one criticism of Collins that I'm kind of on board with, especially when you listen to it in the context of the albums they're on, which are these big, synth-heavy, sometimes really dark songs. These covers really don't make any artistic sense, which kind of leaves you with the conclusion that maybe he just covered these songs because he thought it would make him money. I'm not saying that that's actually the case, because to be honest, I don't think it is. I just don't blame people for coming to that conclusion. The other example of music that he didn't fully make on his own volition are his film soundtracks. Now, obviously, there's the Tarzan soundtrack, which is up there with Disney's best musicals. However, I think a lot of people forget that this song was from a movie too. How can I just let you walk away? Just let you leave without a trace? That's Against All Odds from the movie Against All Odds. And can we just take a second and recognize that Phil Collins is, amongst other things, kind of an amazing singer? I think I started discovering this for the first time listening to his music all the way through. Obviously, he has a pretty distinctive vocal timbre, but I mean, just listen to his vocal and emotional range in this song. You're the only one who really knew me at all. People have called songs like Against All Odds melodramatic and camp. Now, I totally disagree with that. I think that the song has just the right of emotionality, but even if it does verge on over the top, that's okay. It's for a movie. It's supposed to be evocative and dramatic. There was a great Switched on Pop episode recently about power ballads, and Charlie had some interesting thoughts on why this form of emotionality is so often derided.
I think over the top displays of emotion are taboo in Western culture, but certainly I think in certain cultures in the United States, and I also think within certain cultures definitely within the United Kingdom, it's just like the sentimentality is so often sneered at. You can think of someone like Celine Dion. There's an amazing book by Carl Wilson, Let's Talk About Love, which is all about reclaiming the idea, like, actually what is her power is sentimentality. And, like, people love it and relate to it. We should understand why. But it's so often that those kind of displays of emotion are quickly criticized.
Now, I think it's worth saying that Against All Odds did get nominated for an Oscar, but ultimately it lost to the song I Just Called to Say I Love You by Stevie Wonder.
I just called to say I love you.
I am a huge Stevie Wonder fan. He is one of my favorite artists of all time. I definitely love him more than I love Phil Collins. But this song just doesn't do it for me. And if I had to choose between I Just Called to Say I Love You and Against All Odds, there is no question I would pick Against All Odds. Unfortunately, Collins kind of felt the same way, and in an interview with Rolling Stone said that the only reason Stevie Wonder won is, quote, because he's black, blind, lives in LA, and does a lot for human rights, end quote. Not great. And honestly, Collins has plenty of moments when he's put his foot deep within his mouth. As someone who's had haters since the day he became a bandleader, Phil Collins often conducts himself as someone with a gigantic chip on his shoulder, leading him to say things like that, which leads to even more hate, which leads to even more chips on that shoulder. I think when someone's that unlikable, it's easy to have a double standard when it comes to their music. Bernard talks about this in his Guardian article. The things we don't like about his music could easily be applied to other artists who get off scot-free. For instance, Collins gets a lot of flack for making albums upon albums about his divorces, but Bernard argues that so did artists like Marvin Gaye and Bob Dylan. He goes on, quote, "What about his cover of You Can't Hurry Love? Note perfect and reviving Motown's profile for a new generation, but accused of draining any remnant of blackness from it. But again, he was hardly alone in the traducing of 60s classics through the 80s. Michael Bolton, anyone? Naked Eyes?" End quote. So I don't think there's anything wrong with hating these covers, so long as people are consistent with that hate. But I think that the covers and the soundtracks all fed into one of the most common negative labels that Collins is associated with. Dad. He seems totally unbothered by the idea of youth culture, and that can make his music feel immediately out of touch.
Something that I'm curious to what degree Phil Collins, even in his time, was writing music for young people. It's like one of the awkward things about pop music is that oftentimes it's associated heavily with youth, and certainly the creation of rock and roll and the creation of the teenager as even concept and culture. I don't know. I just always feel, but this might just be my association because, like, Phil Collins was played by my dad. But I think that Phil Collins, certainly going solo from Genesis, is like already kind of in like prog rock territory, which is already music which is more for adult listeners who might have like grown up on Led Zeppelin, but like want something sophisticated and a little smooth and comfortable to listen to when they come from home from work. Like, there's a whole world of music, especially that was made in the 80s, that was meant for adults to kick it when they're done with their crappy day at, you know, of hard work. And so, like, maybe Phil Collins was like serving that audience, and thus, since he was serving a not as youthful audience, like, he's like, that's the only theory.
Couple things about this. First, it's worth noting that by the time Phil launched his solo career, he was already in his 30s, which is like 100 in pop years. So right out of the gate, he was a squat, balding man with ill-fitting suits and a dopey smile. Even at his most relevant, he seemed kind of old. The other problem is that Phil Collins is known for these upbeat, happy-go-lucky songs like You Can't Hurry Love or his other incredibly infamous, inane, and nonsensical song, Sue Studio. When songs like these are the first things that pop into people's heads when they think of Phil Collins, of course they're going to picture some happy-go-lucky, out-of-touch, privileged white dude. But if you listen to his albums front to back, you start noticing new things, like the weird song structures and the really dark undertones.
Like, I think when you think of like the 80s and like these power ballads and anthems, a lot of them, you think of like Eye of the Tiger or something very inspirational, but kind of like vague. Like, I feel like Phil Collins' music was dark.
That's Jonah Bayer.
My name is Jonah Bayer. I am a writer and podcaster and living in Western Massachusetts.
Jonah wrote an article for Vice called Why There Will Never Be Another Pop Star Like Phil Collins. The article starts with him admitting that the first concert he ever saw was a Phil Collins concert, and was so embarrassed about this that he used to lie and say that it was Guns N' Roses.
What was the perception of Phil Collins then that you felt the need to lie about what your first concert was?
My mom took me to see Guns N' Roses in Skid Row in 91. Mm. And that was like this really formative concert for me and got me really interested in music and playing guitar and stuff. So I felt like that was, and that just sounded so much cooler. So I think I'd like to lead with like, I saw like, you know, Guns N' Roses, the original kind of lineup. But it's, and I've written about that, but it's interesting that like now I'm still talking about these Phil Collins shows that probably were just seemed like, I don't know how I ended up with them. I wasn't like a massive fan. It just like, you, when you're a kid, like, you know, you just kind of, someone's like, oh, my parents have tickets to this. So like, sure. I remember being pretty awesome. I mean, I do remember I've like looked into it. He did have like a segment where he plays drums, where they have like two drummers. And he's an incredible drummer.
Yeah.
Jonah's article is a really interesting read because the things that for some people make him sound so dated are the same things that make him one of a kind.
A lot of it was dark. I mean, like I referenced like Another Day in Paradise, which was on that But Seriously album. Like it just...
She calls out to the man on the street. Sir, can you help me? It's cold and I'm nowhere to sleep.
Like it's a song about like, you know, our lives are paradise compared to these sort of like disadvantaged or, you know, homeless people, or like think about, you know, keep saying think about it, like think about it. It's about really about like gratitude and kind of having empathy for others. I mean, but it's not really like an upbeat song to listen to. It's kind of like, it's kind of a bummer. In the Air Tonight, like some of these songs, like they're really not necessarily aligned with that like carefree, you know, vision of that era. Like I think his songs were a little bit deeper, a little kind of darker. And I also think,
keep in mind, his first three albums are largely about the pain and depression he suffered during his divorces, so not exactly the upbeat ditties you might have heard on Tarzan. In fact, deep down I think we've always known how dark Phil Collins really is, because we love watching people commit crimes to Phil Collins's music. There's a great article about this on The Ringer by Stephen Hayden, where he kind of outlines this. Between the assassination of Gianni Versace, Mr. Robot, and iconically American Psycho, there seems to be something beneath even Phil Collins' poppiest songs that betrays a darkness that screenwriters have historically honed in on. Another good example of this dark side of Phil Collins is one of his best-known songs, Take Me Home, from his third album, No Jacket Required. No. If you break this song down, it's about a man suffering from insanity in a mental institution. The song is catchy, but the first chorus doesn't come in until 2 minutes and 37 seconds. These are not the touchstones of a shallow, inanely upbeat and corny pop star. And yet, that reputation still persists. The main reason that comes to mind when I think about why is something that I kind of feel bad saying, which is that there was something utterly sexless about Phil Collins. The reason I bring this up is because I'm thinking about his contemporaries, who were people like Prince and Madonna, and I'm not talking about their music, I'm talking more about presentation. But I want to be clear and say that I'm not talking about physical attraction, because I don't necessarily think that people like Michael Jackson or Elton John, for example, were conventionally attractive, but what all of those artists did do is present themselves in their music videos and their live performances as someone that you couldn't take your eyes off of. Especially in the 80s, when presentation was becoming such a big part of what it meant to be an artist, Phil Collins' presentation was so boring and cringy. The funny thing about this is that now that Phil Collins is actually a middle-aged man, there's something that's kind of satisfying about his complete lack of style. And I think this kind of became clear when his performance of In the Air Tonight on Jimmy Fallon went viral. I kind of talked about this with Jonah from Vice.
There was a short-lived meme cycle of like, because he was performing with like, in like jeans and a polo shirt with a collar popped up. And everyone was like, what a legend. Like, imagine giving that little of a shit that you're like on Fallon and like that's how you're dressed.
And yeah, you get the sense that he was like looked like a middle-aged guy in his 20s, and so like now he's just the same, but it's like now it's just working for him maybe, or it's yeah. I mean, I think the idea of like not putting so much effort into like the aesthetics of something like that and like is pretty cool, and I'm like maybe that's like, you know, aligned with, I don't think Phil Collins is like a punk musician, but I think that sort of spirit of like, okay, we're just going to get up here and like, we're not going to put on like a stage outfit or whatever. Right. I think it's kind of refreshing.
But it's not just his fashion sense. It's his whole branding and style, including and especially his music videos. For as many hit songs as Phil Collins has, he doesn't have a single solid music video under his belt. During the same time that Michael Jackson released the Thriller music video, Phil Collins released the video to Sue Studio, which is just him badly dancing to the song in a bar, complete with a balding mullet and ill-fitting gray suit. There's just no comparison. And when I brought this up to Bernard from The Guardian, he agreed, but he had a caveat.
The unfairness of that critique, which I agree with, is that he wasn't doing anything worse than anybody else. When you put him against the more adventurous, striking videos of Madonna and Michael Jackson and to a certain extent Prince, yes, he is. There's nothing striking about him, but in terms of the style of the music video of the 80s, he was making standard 80s music videos. He was no worse than most other contemporary pop artists making music videos at the time. We're struck by the fact that short white guy with a comb over who doesn't in any way look cool and isn't doing anything cool. And so for people who are looking for cool, who are looking for difference, who are looking for individuality, that's not there. But again, the bulk of the people who were watching music videos in the 80s who were buying music based on music videos, they were quite happy to see the crashing waves on Lovers on the Beach or the guy wandering through a series of rooms with the wind blowing the curtains out and someone looking contemplative at a window. I mean, that was everywhere. And Phil Collins would make those videos and he was no worse than anybody else.
But my counter-argument to that is Phil Collins isn't your average 80s pop star. Again, we're talking about 150 million records worldwide. So when we talk about all the things that are quote-unquote wrong with Phil Collins, we have to acknowledge that those things must not have mattered all that much given how successful he was. Although, perhaps the success is exactly what people had a problem with. In Bernard's article in The Guardian, he wrote, quote, "Perhaps the real problem was that he sold too much, was around too much, played everywhere, and produced too much. Even he's admitted that his presence in seemingly anything that happened in the 1980s would have got up his nose too if he had been watching," end quote.
I have a theory. Maybe the problem is that Phil Collins has become a Kleenex. Perhaps he's actually somebody whose sound was creative at the time. Perhaps he was part of bringing these sounds and like they were his own identity and brand, but then everybody else just stole them to the point where they became utterly ubiquitous that you don't necessarily actually even associate Phil Collins with any of those sounds. You just hear 1980s because everyone else also used them. Like that's, again, it's not like he was the only person doing these sounds. There were, you know, other people using drum machines, synthesizers, so on and whatnot, but he really formed his aesthetic around them, and lots of other people did too.
For decades, people have been operating under the idea that the things that made Phil Collins, Phil Collins, aren't supposed to make someone a pop superstar, that maybe he was just an exception to the rule. But as I talked about with Charlie, people like The Weeknd and Carly Rae Jepsen are bringing his sound back. Now that an 80s renaissance is underway, I kind of wonder if maybe a reckoning is coming for Phil Collins' legacy. And Phil Collins deserves a reckoning. There's an infamous Rolling Stone profile from 2011 written by Eric Hedgaard, where Collins is presented as a broken man, physically and spiritually, contemplating how seemingly meaningless his life has been, both to him and to his listeners. Collins says in the piece, quote, "I sometimes think, I'm going to write this Phil Collins character out of the story. Phil Collins will just disappear or be murdered in some hotel bedroom, and people will say, 'What happened to Phil?' And the answer will be, 'He got murdered. But yeah, anyway, let's carry on.'" End quote. The profile is a portrait of a man who's been beaten up one too many times. Luckily, Phil Collins has pushed past this phase, and he seems to be doing much better. So here's hoping that now that Genesis is going on tour, and people like The Weeknd are bringing back in-your-face synths, gated drums, and deceptively dark lyrics, Phil Collins will yet throw the last punch. Guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Skip Button. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review, and spread the word. As always, word of mouth really helps, so thank you in advance. A huge, huge thanks to everyone who contributed to this episode, including and especially Colin Purcell, Bernard Zuhl, Charlie Harding, and Jonah Bayer. Check out more of Bernard Zuhl's writing at bernardzuhl.net. Check out the amazing Vulture podcast, Switched on Pop, hosted by Charlie and Nate Sloan. Also check out their book, Switched on Pop, How Popular Music Works and Why It Matters. And if you want to read more of Jonah Bayer's work, go to jonahbayer.com. Links for all of those will be in the podcast description. As always, I'm on Instagram at skipbuttonpodcast. I've also recently joined Twitter, so you can find me at barsnearme. Social media is where I announce upcoming episodes and try to get a sense of why people hate certain music so much. So keep your eyes peeled for announcements and questions, and definitely don't hesitate to reach out if you have a suggestion of who I should talk about and what I should say about them. Until then, thanks again, and I will see you next time on The Skip Button. Thanks, guys.